Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we're embarking on a journey into a topic that has a reputation for being a bit dusty, but is actually far more dynamic and relevant than you might think.
We're talking about the profound history of monasticism.
Exactly. And we're drawing our insights from Stephen Jay Davis's foundational work, which gives us this incredible global and functional overview of the whole phenomenon.
And I think when most people hear the word monk, they picture a silent, solitary figure, someone totally cut off from
the symbol of passivity, right?
Totally. And we are here to challenge that stereotype completely. Our mission in this deep dive is to show that monasticism across all sorts of different faiths has always been more like a laboratory of faith.
I love that phrase, laboratory of faith. It's so fitting. These were vibrant, adaptable, and often surprisingly powerful social forces. They weren't just fleeing the world, they were actively experimenting with radical new ways to live.
And why should you, our listener, care about this right now? Think about the age we live in. It's just constant distraction, information overload.
A sense of fragmentation.
Yeah. And the ancient monastic commitment to discipline, to contemplation, to intentional community, it holds these surprisingly potent blueprints for anyone trying to build a focused, meaningful life today.
To guide us through all this, we're turning to Professor Stephen Jay Davis, who is an absolute authority in this field. He's a professor of religious studies and history at Yale.
And what's so great about Davis is his specialization. It gives him this rock-solid foundation. He spent years focused on ancient and medieval Christianity, specifically the origins of the movement in Egypt.
The desert fathers and mothers, yeah. He knows the Coptic history inside and out.
Right. And that deep knowledge lets him develop a really distinctive perspective. He consciously moves beyond all the, dry theological debates.
He's much more concerned with what he calls lived religion.
Lived religion. What does that mean exactly?
It's about how spiritual beliefs get translated into the gritty, daily, physical reality of life in a community. How do you actually do it?
Okay. So it's that dual expertise, deep knowledge of Christian origins, plus this broad thematic vision that makes him the perfect guide for deep dive like this.
Yeah, absolutely. It lets him compare these traditions globally, Buddhism, Hinduism, and define monasticism not by faith, but by its function.
So let's get right into that. His central argument. Davis says we should, basically stop defining monasticism by its theology or assuming it's just a Christian thing.
Right. He says it's a diverse global practice defined by what the practitioners actually do, its functional characteristics.
And he gives us this three-part framework, a kind of triad. The first is
asceticism. And this is a big one because it's so often misunderstood. People hear asceticism and they think self-punishment.
Starving yourself, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But Davis clarifies it as structured, voluntary self-discipline. Things like fasting, long vigils, celibacy, all aimed at transformation. It's less about suffering and more like spiritual athletic conditioning.
I like that. So what's the second characteristic?
The second is separation. This is the deliberate withdrawal from mainstream society.
So literally going out into the desert.
It could be geographical, moving to a desert or a remote mountain. But it could also just be social, adopting a specific way of dressing or a different daily rhythm, even inside a city. The key is creating that distance.
Okay, so you have asceticism and separation. What's the third?
The alternative community. You withdraw, but you don't necessarily stay alone. You join a new, structured way of life, bound by a shared commitment.
And this whole framework leads directly to the central paradox of the book, which is just fascinating.
It really is. Monks renounce the world. They take vows of poverty and isolation.
Yet time and time again, their communities become these incredibly powerful hubs of economic and political life. They end up shaping the very world they tried to leave behind.
And this is why it's so relevant today. For any intentional group, a startup, a nonprofit, the question is always the same. How do you maintain your mission, your integrity, while dealing with all the pressures from the outside world?
The monks offer a blueprint.
A blueprint built on structure. It's a long-term solution.
Okay, let's dive into the history a bit and see this in action. We can start in, what, 4th and 5th century Egypt?
Mm-hmm.
Davis calls it an ascetic marketplace.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really interesting. This was not a quiet, private spirituality. It was highly public. It was competitive.
Competitive? How so?
These athletes of God were out there publicly demonstrating their extreme self-denial to gain spiritual authority.
So the classic example here is Anthony of Egypt. He's the archetypal hermit. Right? Mm. Battling demons out in the desert.
He is. And you'd think this extreme withdrawal would lead to total isolation. But the exact opposite happened. His radical discipline made him famous. It was the source of his charisma.
So people started seeking him out.
Countless disciples. His solitary life accidentally sparked a powerful public movement.
But how public are we talking here? Because the case of Simeon Stylites, it just gets wild.
Well, Simeon is the most extreme example. He spent, what, 37 years living on top of a stone pillar?
37 years. To our modern minds, that sounds like a performance artist trying to go viral, not a humble monk.
Yeah.
How does Davis explain that?
Well, that's the genius of his approach. He shows that the public performance was the source of their power. Simeon's visible suffering was proof of his holiness.
And people flocked to him.
Thousands of pilgrims. They saw him as this spiritual celebrity. He gained immense social authority. He was an arbitrator in disputes, a healer, a spiritual patron. It just shows that even in the most physically remote state, these figures were profoundly connected to society.
But that kind of chaotic charisma,
yeah,
it can't last, right? It's not sustainable.
Exactly. And that leads to the next massive shift in the story, the move from these radical individuals to enduring institutions.
And the key to that was the monastic rule.
The rule. A written blueprint for daily life, for ethics, for structure. It was revolutionary.
And the most important one for the West is the rule of Saint Benedict.
The rule of Saint Benedict of Nursia, yes. Its genius was its balance and moderation, its practical wisdom. Benedict basically transformed monasticism from something for spiritual superheroes into a sustainable lifestyle for ordinary people.
And it was that structure that allowed it to endure for so long. The day was divided between prayer, ora, and work, labra.
Right. And that wasn't just a nice slogan. It was a rigorous schedule that created a stable, self-regulating society, a society built not on kinship, but on shared commitment.
Which allowed these communities to outlive their founders, to outlive entire kingdoms.
Okay, but we have to tackle that great paradox we mentioned. How did these communities founded on poverty become such huge economic and political players?
It seems like a total contradiction.
But it was almost unavoidable. Their spiritual success led directly to material wealth. People saw them as holy, and they desperately wanted their prayers.
So wealthy patrons, kings, nobles, they start donating land and money.
Exactly. The spiritual economy drove the material economy.
And they didn't just sit on that wealth. They became powerful economic entities in their own right.
Oh, absolutely. They were pioneers in land management, agriculture, even technology, things like viticulture and metallurgy. They were incredibly efficient.
And of course, economic influence always bleeds into political power.
Always. Abbots became key advisors to emperors and kings. And crucially, during periods of collapse in Europe, these stable communities became the places where knowledge was preserved.
The scriptoria, where they copied all those manuscripts.
Meticulously. They withdrew to pray, but in doing so, they ended up preserving the intellectual foundation of Western civilization.
So let's fast forward. How does this ancient tradition adapt to the challenges of modernity? You know, secularism, revolutions.
It adapts. It doesn't disappear. It just changes its form. You see this with figures like the 20th century Trappist monk, Thomas Merton.
Right. He made contemplative life make sense to a modern secular audience. And he didn't just sit quietly. His contemplation fueled his activism for peace mm-hmm. and social justice.
And you see a similar thing with the Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh. He showed the world that monastic discipline isn't about escaping pain. It's about facing it with mindfulness and translating that inner peace into compassionate action.
The lesson seems to be that disciplined contemplation is the foundation for effective action in the world.
I think that's a perfect way to put it.
So let's try to distill a few key themes from all this that are universally significant, no matter what you believe personally.
Okay. First, I would say it's the paradox of withdrawal and engagement. The monks knew that to offer a truly alternative vision, they had to maintain a kind of prophetic distance from the dominant culture.
Right, from consumerism, from all the noise. And that raises a question for all of us, doesn't it? Do we need to consciously step back from the constant media and work pressure to maintain our own vision?
I think so. The second theme would be the body as the arena of spiritual transformation. Davis really emphasizes that asceticism isn't about self-punishment. It's about mastering the body's desires to reorient the whole self.
So our daily habits, our sleep, our diet, what we give our attention to, that's the modern battlefield for intentional living. Your physical routine is a reflection of your priorities.
Exactly. And the third theme is the democratization of sanctity. Monasticism offered a structured path to a serious spiritual life that didn't require you to be a martyr or a bishop.
But hold on, was it really democratized? I mean, the requirements, poverty, celibacy, waking up at 2 a.m., that's brutally difficult.
That's a fair point. It was incredibly difficult. But compared to the other paths to holiness available at the time, the rule provided a repeatable, documented structural path. It taught that long-term growth comes from discipline and routine, not just from one-off heroic acts.
It formalized the process.
Right.
Made it accessible, if not easy.
Right.
The book is just packed with these memorable ideas. Let's pull out a few quotes, starting with how Davis defines the whole thing.
Quote one, functional definition. Monasticism is best defined not by a specific belief system, but as a dynamic way of life characterized by three core elements: ascetic discipline, separation from the world, and life in an alternative community.
And that's so powerful because it shifts the focus from belief to action.
Yeah.
It makes it a global human strategy.
It does. Then there's quote two, the paradox. The history of monasticism is filled with the paradox of holy men and women who renounced worldly wealth and power only to find their communities becoming extraordinarily wealthy and powerful as a result of their perceived holiness.
The ultimate irony. The attempt to reject power is what gave them power.
It's that unavoidable entanglement. And finally, on structure, quote three, institutional genius. The monastic rule was a revolutionary technology for social organization, capable of lasting for centuries.
It just reminds us that resilience isn't an accident. It's engineered, it's designed.
So how do we take this blueprint and apply it to our own lives without, you know, moving to a cave?
Good question. One idea is application one, a modern rule for focus. We can translate the Benedictine Ora et Labora prayer and work into a modern schedule of deep work and reflection.
So scheduling inviolable blocks of time for your most important work and also time for intentional reflection.
Exactly. That structured rhythm is how you cut through the modern noise.
I'm really drawn to application two, digital asceticism. Monks practiced fasting to gain spiritual freedom. We can do the same to gain mental freedom.
By intentionally limiting our exposure to social media to the news cycle.
Yes. Renouncing that addictive pull. It's an act of reclaiming your own attention, just like the monks renounced worldly chatter to hear a deeper voice.
And let's not forget application three, valuing silence and solitude. In our world, we rarely experience true silence.
We really don't. So actually scheduling time to be alone and silent. A walk without headphones, 10 minutes of meditation. The monks saw this as essential for creativity and self-reflection.
For me, the most surprising thing from this whole deep dive was that idea of the ascetic marketplace, that competitive public nature of it all.
Simeon on his pillar.
Simeon on his pillar. It shows that the impulse to seek authority through discipline is still alive. It's just that today, the pillar might be a viral video and the self-denial is broadcast for likes. The human dynamic hasn't changed that much.
That's a great point. My final thought is that monasticism is so much more than a historical oddity. It's a persistent part of the human journey. And the real insight for me is that this ancient search for meaning, discipline, and community provides the exact tools we need to navigate modern life more purposefully. At the end of the day, structure is the ultimate freedom. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.